The Hollywood film director Edward Dmytryk writes of the press in his recent memoir, It's a Hell of a Life, but Not a Bad Living. Dmytryk writes, "In my experience with the press, I have rarely been quoted accurately, in context, or in full. Generally, the reporters get not what you have to say, but what they are looking for, even if they have to twist, senselessly edit, or even add a few words of their own." Well, this may be, but tonight we'll let Dmytryk speak for himself on Alternative Views. Welcome to Alternative Views. Our guest tonight is Edward Dmytryk, the Hollywood film director who directed such films in the 1950s as The Caine Mutiny, Soldier of Fortune with Clark Gable, The Left Hand of God with Humphrey Bogart, and two of my favorite films of the period, Raintree County and The Young Lions, which I played hooky from high school to see in Times Square, thus no doubt saving me from Times Square pornography. Dmytryk has made some 51 films from 1935 to 1975 and began working in Hollywood as a messenger in 1923. Hence, his career has spanned practically the entire history of the Hollywood film. We're currently honored to have him here as a guest professor in the Radio, Television, Film Department of the university. And tonight on Alternative Views, we're going to discuss his career with him, including the notoriety he gained as a member of the so-called Hollywood Ten, who were some of the film people in Hollywood who were cited for contempt of Congress by the notorious House of American Un-American Activities Committee and who served some time in jail as a result. Tonight we're going to discuss his film career, talking about his experiences in Hollywood, his experiences with the Communist Party and the HUAC Committee Witch Hunters, and his big movies and working with such Hollywood stars as Gable, Bogart, Marlon Brando, and the other superstars. Also participating in the discussion is Tom Schatz, a professor of RTF here at the university and author of a forthcoming book, Hollywood Film Genres. So welcome to Alternative Views, Tom and Ed. Before beginning, I might note that Edward Dmytryk has also just published his memoirs entitled It's a Hell of a Life, but Not a Bad Living, which blends some of his personal biography, stories of Hollywood and his film career and his political experiences in quite a fascinating fashion. The book begins, "My life has been one long roller coaster ride. I've had more ups and downs than a two-bit whore in a London lumber camp." Well, let's begin by talking about some of these ups and downs in Hollywood. Ed, how did you first get into
Let's
the
not
film?
Louse up our quotes either, shall we?
Okay. Ed, how did you get into films in Hollywood?
Today or when I got in?
In the 1920s. What were your first experiences?
Yeah, it was a lot easier then than it is now because it wasn't all a competition. I happened to be living in Hollywood at that time, and I left home when I was 14. As I said, we were living in Hollywood, and I had to go to work to work my way through high school, and there were darn few places to work. Then you could work in the Orange Orchards, or you could work in the studios, and through a friend, I got a job in one of the studios as a messenger boy. I made $6 a week working after school on Saturdays, and it cost me $6 a week to rent a sleeping porch at a private home and get breakfast and dinner.
So you broke even.
I broke even, yeah.
What was your first sort of technical experience with the films?
Well, I used to sneak into the projection rooms because I found that much more interesting, of course, than carrying messages. Actually, I was a messenger boy in the laboratory. It was a job that was kind of made for me so that I had very little to do. And I used to sneak into the projection rooms. I learned how to run the projection machines of that time, which were very complicated because in those days we had there were no motors to set your arcs and all that kind of thing. And I was able to give the projectionist time off to smoke and stuff. So then every once in a while, the boss of the lab would come and kick me out and get me back over to the other the sample copy room, we called it. And I'd sneak back in. And eventually they decided to give up and they allowed me to become a projectionist. So I did that through most of high school. And actually, even while I was going to, I went to college for a year, went to Caltech. But I was still working in the, you know, on weekends and holidays and that sort of thing.
Which films impressed you the most of the early silent films?
I can't remember that because particularly, I wasn't expecting to work in films. I didn't expect to go on and work in films. That was just a job to me. In other words, I wasn't a film crazy kid who wanted to be in the studios. I thoroughly expected to give it up, you know, when I got through the university. But I do remember one man whose work impressed me tremendously, and that's Murnau, Franz Murnau. I liked his films. I liked Metropolis. No, Metropolis wasn't his. That was Lang's. I liked the very first thing he did, which was I've forgotten.
Nosferatu.
Yeah, Nosferatu, and but particularly The Last Laugh. Which, now, I ran those things in the projection room. I got to see them, which I really think was a very valuable experience. I got to see those in the original. Sunrise, which he made in America for Fox, actually, was one of my favorites. But I got to see all those films in their original versions. For instance, I'll never forget Variety, which was a very different film than the one that they finally edited for American consumption, and a much better film the way it was originally. The same thing is true, for instance, later on, this was actually after sound came in. Ecstasy was a very interesting film. We edited it into a kind of a pornographic film, and with bad taste. This is what I object to. And this was done to many of those things. I was lucky to see them in their original versions.
Did you find watching the film several times give you a certain perspective that, or more of a sensitivity to what was going on technically?
I really don't know, because, as I say, I cannot remember that. And since I had no intention of continuing in the business, I doubt that I was looking at them with an eye to learning anything. I couldn't help but absorb. Mm-hmm. I got to know the people. For instance, I think one of the most interesting episodes in that period of my life was that I ran von Stroheim's first cut of The Wedding March. Mm-hmm. And that was 126 reels long and took over 2 days to run, just the first cut, mind you. He worked on it for 6 months and never could get it under 80-some-odd reels, and they had to throw him off finally and get a cutter mm-hmm. to come in and try to cut it down to size. So I was able to watch that. I had to watch it. And there was a scene where von Stroheim, who's an officer in the cavalry on a horse, they're guarding a parade of Franz Joseph, looking down at the peasant girl played by Faye Ray, and the flirtation goes on, and he carried it on for two full reels for 20 minutes, just looking down at her, and she's looking up at him, and her boyfriend takes a big chew of sausage, and then, you know, she looks back up at him, he looks back, this went on and on and on and on. Talk about realism, you know.
You said you learned a certain lesson from that, not to make films in too much detail, but to capture the essential details.
That's
Can
right.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, yes, because this is one of the things about, you get into great arguments, particularly with the scholastic types, about realism and reality and all that kind of thing. And, of course, I think I have a reputation as being a very realistic director, but actually everything we do is false, starting with the film itself, the way it works. We see a series of still pictures. We don't see a moving picture. It looks as though it's moving, but it actually isn't. And my theory is, or my practice is, to work in many devious ways to make it look real, but it isn't actually real. One of the things, as I say, that too much detail sometimes can kill the detail. You can have too many trees, and you don't see the forest or the trees either, actually. All you see is a lot of matchsticks, and this is what happens in a case like this. I think you have to be, you have to work out everything in very, very careful detail with the end result of making it look as real as possible, but it isn't real getting up to there. Mm-hmm. You know, the real effect has to be in the audience's mind, and if you examine the film carefully, you'll probably find it isn't real at all.
Mm. You made a Tom.
I was just going to ask, when did you start getting serious about thinking of yourself as a filmmaker? When you started cutting for Paramount? You started cutting in 29, is that right?
I started cutting in 29. Yes, probably about that time. And even then, I'm one of those strange characters, and I imagine that the thousands of people who want to get in the film business now would consider me very lucky in that I never had a real drive. I was never ambitious. I was never ridden by a desire to do this or that, the other thing. It was a way of making a living at first. You know? Mm-hmm. Then I went to Caltech. I was majoring in mathematical physics. I decided all I could be was a professor, and I didn't want to be a professor at the time. I reached it much later. So I decided to go back and work in film. Besides, the glamour had gotten me somewhat anyway, because it was always, particularly in those days, it was a very interesting business. And so I decided to make a career. But the original idea was that it was just a good way to make a living, and I didn't know what I was going to be. Somebody had said, well, why don't you go into the camera department? Somebody else said something else. Now, it happened that when I, after I decided to quit Caltech and work full-time in Hollywood, sound was coming in. And the cutters particularly, the cutting became with the added track, and at that time they had no numbering, no way to keep it in sync. And most of the cutters were women, and this was a very anti-feminist period. Right. They didn't believe that the women could handle the technical aspects. Mm-hmm. Some of the women didn't believe they could handle it either, which was kind of silly, but they were, you know.
Still true today to some degree. Hmm? They still hide women editors back in the dark rooms.
Yeah, but they have a lot of them. And in those days, of course, we had the studio. Most of the cutters at the studio were women. Mm-hmm. But so they had to get assistance now. Before, they hadn't had assistance. And anybody who knew something, I came from Caltech, my God, I had a, you know, they wanted me because they figured I could handle anything technical at all. And so I became an assistant cutter. And I don't know whether, if it hadn't been for that particular thing, whether I would have even gone into the cutting department. And of course, that fascinated me. Cutting is a fascinating business. It's really one of the pure arts in films. And then from then on, eventually, I became a director. Again, sort of by accident, not looking for it particularly.
Well, how did you get to be a director? What were your experiences?
I was put as a co-director with, but without any authority, in second position, with a man whom they didn't trust. They had a contract to make a B film, mind you. It would have been much cheaper to pay him off. Would have cost him a couple of $1,000s and get somebody else. But instead of that, they put me with him to help him, as it were. Well, the man was put in an impossible position. He didn't even want to talk to me, obviously. And he certainly didn't want my help. So the studio was obviously looking for him to fail. And in 3 or 4 days, looking at rushes, they decided that he was failing. So they decided to fire him. And since it's very costly to change directors in the middle of a film, they called me in and asked me if I thought I could carry on and finish it.
And being young and courageous.
Being young and courageous. What young man says no to a thing like that? And so I went ahead and finished it. I did no better than he would have done. I probably did no worse, but I certainly did no better. But they were very happy with it. They gave me a contract, and I was off on B Pictures.
One thing before we leave your editing career, I've been fascinated by the fact that Paramount in the 30s, early 30s anyway, there was a policy apparently, at least with certain directors, that the film editor, the cutter, would be on the set with the director, and you worked with McCary apparently in a couple
films.
That's
right, and Cukor and others. No, this was a general policy, and as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that helped me to direct. For instance, Cukor knew to some extent, I think he still knows very little about the camera because he's never wanted to. He's always been frightened. He came from the theater.
Right.
He's one of the few directors who came from the theater who succeeded in Hollywood. Most of them didn't, but he's one of the few who did. And so I used to pick his setups. He'd rehearse the scene, and I'd pick his setups for him. And so the studio knew that, and they knew that I could handle a camera. They knew that, you know, so this helped me in getting a break directing. What was the other?
Well, I wanted just to ask you, what were the B films? What's the difference between A and B films?
Well, B films were films that were made very cheaply to begin with, and they were normally aimed at the bottom half of a double bill. Double bills came in with the Depression, and B pictures came in with double bills because they had to have more pictures to show, obviously, twice as much as they normally would. And they were made very cheaply, and there was usually a routine. For instance, when I left Paramount, which I did after my contract lasted for a year, the department changed, and everybody was fired and thrown out. So I got a job at Columbia, and there I did a Boris Karloff thriller, I did a couple of Lone Wolves, I did a Boston Blackie, these kind of things. Now, they had a formula. They paid each of those men $15,000 per film. Now, the films took 2 weeks to shoot. If they made them at a certain price, and the price varied a little bit, I think they could afford to spend more on a Karloff film than the other two, but not too much. If they could make a Karloff film for, say, $105,000, They knew that they could make a profit of around $30,000 or $35,000, because there were that many people in the United States who would go to see a Karloff film regardless.
Guaranteed, right.
No more than that, but that many. It, of course, if it turned out to be a fantastic picture, then they could make
the
more, but they
right.
usually weren't at that, right. you know. And that's the same way with the others. So they had these, in other words, Columbia, which was the black hole of Calcutta in Hollywood at that time, the cheapest studio and known as that, and paid the poorest salaries before the unions got organized, existed essentially on B's. The other studios, Paramount and MGM, Warners, who were making the fine pictures, there were years when they were, you know, really down in the bucket. Columbia always sailed along, making a couple hundred thousand a year profit or something like that, never going into the red.
What years did you work at Columbia?
I went over there in 1940 for my first film.
Just at the end of Cohn's?
No. Cohn lasted for a long time.
48, did he wind up?
Oh, Cohn was...
Big power struggle in the 40s.
No, Cohn
right?
was still there in the early 60s.
That long?
Yes, yeah.
Gags.
Right up until the day he died. Until just before he died. Yeah.
How did you get from the B films to the A film? What was your first major A film production?
Well, before you have your first... major A film production, you have to have a major B film production, because mm-hmm. that's how you get from one to the other. And you look around for the, you don't look, you just hope that one of these days they're going to hand you a story which is better than the usual tripe they hand you, and you're going to get a cast which is a little bit better than the usual people you've been getting, and that maybe if you're lucky, but you don't, you're going to get a little more time. Anyway, you're going to get lucky somehow or other and get something that's interesting. Well, of course, the war came along, and I think it was in, I've forgotten the exact date, but I believe it was in 1943 at RKO. They gave me a picture called Hitler's Children, which was a propaganda picture about about an American kid in Germany at the time when the Nazis took over. And it cost $100,000 to produce, to make, and it cleared $7.5 million in just the United States, Canada, and England alone, because at that time all of Europe was occupied, of course, by Nazis, and they wouldn't show the picture there. They wouldn't even show it in Argentina, which was part of the Japanese, as you know, German Axis at the time. So when you get that kind of a thing, make a picture for $100,000, which makes $7.5 million, obviously
you're
if you've got something, you know,
right.
you're on your way. So I was given, I made $500 for making that picture. And of course they didn't know what they had until after the picture came out. I went and made another film at Universal during that time, a B picture, because I had to eat, called Captive Wild Woman, I remember. But by the time I finished making that, Hitler Children was out and was doing sensational business. It gave me a new contract, it gave me a $5,000 bonus, 10 times as much as I had made. That's a pretty good bonus. And
that seems incredible. You only got paid $500 for making that movie?
Right, yeah.
So people weren't getting rich as directors of the B's then?
Well, no. I started out, I was making, that was my salary throughout the B's, because that's about all they could ever afford. If you were working on a weekly basis, $250 a week. Now, what I got actually, for instance, when I was at Columbia, I got $2,000 per film. But I actually spend so much more than the average B director, because I prepared my pictures, I worked on the script, of course I shot them, and then I insisted on cutting them afterwards, and that took a long time, and seeing them right through the dubbing. Other directors would come in because all they were interested in was making the money, and they would make 12 or 13 of those in a year. They would, the minute they finished the picture, they handed it to the cutter, they went off and started on another picture.
Did you have to battle with the studio to get that much control over your production?
Oh, no, they were glad. They were glad.
Save
because
money.
Yeah, they knew that they were getting better, somebody better to work
better
on it
product,
than they normally
yeah.
would get. It would just, and they didn't have to pay me nearly as much. So that I would make about four or five pictures a year. I was lucky to clear $12,000 and $10,000 or $12,000, but I was happy because I was looking, I never cared about money anyway, and I was looking forward to the future. I figured if I did a good job, that I would have a better chance of going. The other directors who were doing that quick stuff stayed in B's for as long as they lived.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it was Murder, My Sweet then that was your breakthrough. Was that 1945?
Yes. Yeah, so that was 44. No, I think it was 44.
44.
I started.
Released,
I made it. It released in
45.
Yeah. Well, that was my first film that I did as a so-called A director. Now, actually, that wasn't, in a sense, that really wasn't truly an A picture, although it became one. That was a cheap picture. It cost about $450,000. It took about 44 days to make. It was what we would have called a B plus. It had a cast which was very doubtful. Dick Powell had been a tenor in the old musical days in Warners, and a very fine one, but he hadn't done anything for several years. Nobody assumed he could do a tough guy. We took a chance on him. The reason we chose cast Dick Powell for the part was we didn't want it. The producer didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. The head of the studio wanted to do it because he was thinking about bringing back musicals. Matter of fact, it got Sinatra about that time, and he wanted Powell for musicals, but Powell refused to sign a contract unless he could do a tough guy picture, and he had read our script and loved it, wanted to do it. Actually, Dick never did do another musical. He never sang again in his life, except to his wife, who didn't like it. This was, as I say, this was a kind of a, what we call a B plus or an A minus, but it turned out to be a minor sensation for the studio. And
you directed some pretty incredible films in the 40s, Edward. Earlier, your 50s films were mentioned, but when I think of films like Crossfire and Cornered and Murder My Sweet and Give Us This Day, and those are, you mentioned earlier also that you are generally thought of as a more realistic film director. But I find those 40s films very stylized, your black and white work.
Of course you're stylized,
In a variety of ways, not only your camera work, but especially your lighting and your set design. How much control did you have over those types of things?
Well, complete control. As far as, nobody, you know, I set the camera. Nobody, some people have the idea that the cameraman is responsible for the setups. Mm-hmm. This is not true with any director that I know of outside of a few, like, say, perhaps George Cukor.
Mm-hmm.
The cameraman is responsible for the lighting. Mm-hmm. In England, they call him the lighting man rather than the cameraman. I'm responsible for all the setups, for all the composition, for the character of the lighting. Now, I don't like the set. Usually what I do is I tell a cameraman what I want. Mm-hmm. Very often I will take some painter, like, you can imagine, for that period, it was Daumier.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, this is the kind of lighting, the very high-key lighting that Daumier uses in his paintings.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind I want. Now, I expect a good cameraman to go out and get me more than I could possibly ever have gotten, more than I even expected. And
did you think of yourself as experimenting in those films?
Not at all, no.
Where were you working from? How are you visualizing? Let me describe for the audience a couple of things. There's a scene in Murder, My Sweet, where Dick Powell and Mike Mazurki walk up the stairway. And I understand that you actually had the set designer collapse the walls and the ceiling down
right.
for a claustrophobic effect.
Right.
It's an incredible
yeah.
Visual sequence. They are going up into an abyss, as it were.
That's right.
And very strangely lit, very almost surreal scene in terms
of... Well, also very much like German Expressionism. It's interesting you mentioned Murnau earlier.
Right.
Because it was the Germans that used the shading of lighting, the play.
I never knew anything about Expressionism.
Where were these ideas coming from,
Edward? I was inventing it for myself. Actually, what that was, I think my scientific, even short as it was, helped me a little bit. But what I wanted to do there, I wanted to keep the feeling of size, because he was going upstairs with Moose, and
mm-hmm.
a thing took place in the saloon when he got up there that was interesting because of Moose's size. And I thought, you just see Moose walking along, so he's a big man. But if he's walking up a stairway, and as he walks away from it, he doesn't diminish in size. As a matter of fact, he seems to grow. Now, that's a thing that the average person isn't going to say. They're not going to be able to analyze it that quickly and say, hey, he's walking away from us, but he's still not diminishing. He seemed to be growing because the set was artificially diminishing on him so that he got bigger. But I was just in my mind, I thought, that's going to be a very interesting effect. I didn't,
mm-hmm.
Certainly I didn't copy it from anybody. I'd never seen anybody do that. I don't know that anybody else ever had
mm-hmm.
done that. I did the same thing inside the bar. I brought the ceiling down
right.
so that... that he towered, you know, close to the ceiling. I made the doors a little bit shorter so that he had to duck under them as he went through each one.
There's
know?
A later dream sequence where Dick Powell is shot up with drugs by some heavy
yeah.
bad guys. And it's some very nice surrealistic type of things with the fingers reaching towards the camera and the clouds
right.
and all that
yeah.
business. Were you operating, how did you design that sequence?
No, just worked it out actually. I got a designer to draw pictures for me and worked it out cut by cut. That's all. And as a matter of fact, I think Hitchcock, even in his book, says that he called the studio to find out how we did it. And I know that Selznick did. He was making Spellbound at
right.
that time, and they
right.
wanted to see our montage. Because
and there are seven or eight films in the late 40s yeah. that very clearly. A Dark Passage strikes my mind initially with the Bogart film where he is plastic surgery, and there's a scene that designed supposedly by Salvador Dali that looks like it's lifted right out of your movie.
Well, I've seen a lot of scenes lifted out of my movies. And as a matter of fact, I've had a lot of people confess to me, which is nice to hear, that they have... I remember Michael Caine once told me that... he said the director of the Ipcress file, he said that
mm-hmm.
they all looked at at Murder, My Sweet, and Crossfire over and over and over again, and they actually stole some of the, they altered them slightly,
stole some of the things.
Yeah. I saw just the other day in TV Fritzens, I saw the thing of the hands against the glass, people touching hands throughout the glass. Well, I used that in The Young Lions, how long ago, and I don't know, TV has done it to death since then. It's flattering in a way when they copy you.
Well, imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, they say.
But it's also dull and cliche when they do it too much.
Too many people go back to yours and don't realize this, that was
the initial. Yeah, they don't even remember where it came from now.
Well, I might note that during the 1940s, some of Mr. Dimitrik's films were the most popular in Hollywood, so he became known as Mr. RKO, which was the name of his studio. He was the most successful and popular director they had.
I could never understand it.
And, well, just as you were at seemingly the very top of your Hollywood career, you suddenly got a letter from Washington and were invited to the hottest act in town.
Not a letter, a pink subpoena.
A pink subpoena. Well, what was this all about?
Well, this was, there was the Hollywood right-winger. After the war, when you look at it, back at it historically, it was almost inevitable because although, particularly those of us who were leftist socialists were hoping great things would happen after the war, that there would be peace in the world and that the Russians and the Americans and the French and the English would all embrace each other and love each other and everything would go wonderfully. Well, that isn't the way the practical people looked at it. And I found out much later that plans were being made even while the war was still being fought for the Cold War. And of course, the people that knew most about that were the right-wingers. They were scared to death of what Russia would do after the war, and they were right. So they were trying to protect themselves and their interests. And one of the ways, what they were afraid of in Hollywood, I know a great deal was made out of, was there communist propaganda in films, which is nonsense. How the hell can you put propaganda into films that the head of the studio, who was a first-class capitalist, will pass, you know, won't notice, and yet the blue-collar worker in the street will? It's ridiculous. It just doesn't make sense. But what was happening was that they were getting into the unions. And as a matter of fact, we had a well-known strike, well-known in Hollywood, called the Painter's Strike, Sorrell's Strike. He was a painter's union that at that time was part of the CIO. And the CIO, which your memories may not go back that far, but at one time the CIO was a liberal union. It isn't any longer. But
it was left-wing, actually.
It was left-wing. And so the right-wingers were afraid that the left-wingers would come into Hollywood and take over the unions first, you see, and then eventually take over Hollywood. This was what the real battle was about.
Well, in fact, the studios didn't even want unions at all, did they?
Oh, no.
Didn't they do everything possible to break unions?
The Wagner National Labor Relations Act is what caused it. And then what they did, that was, of course, not too long after Roosevelt got into office, in about 34, 35. Then what the studios did, was to try to set up company unions. And, of course, they were successful in those areas that hadn't been unionized before to a large extent. Like, I helped to establish the Screen Editors Guild because I was still an editor at that time. And they said, we'll have an organization, everybody will belong to it, we won't do anything, we won't make any demands, we'll have a dinner dance every year, you know, and that's it. Well, I said, that's kind of ridiculous, because you get an organization and it won't be long before people will be coming to you and saying, hey, I'm not getting paid enough, do something about it, you know, get off your butt. And that's exactly what happened. The first thing you know, the things that had been formed as sort of brotherly guilds became
interest group,
dynamic
unions,
you know, they wanted to, and it was bound to happen.
Well, why did Washington get after Hollywood?
Well, because Hollywood got after Washington. It's as simple as that. C.B. DeMille, primarily, who was one of the, perhaps the leader of the right-wing faction in Hollywood, and then through various people like Ward Bond and John Wayne and Hedda Hopper and people like that, went to the representatives in Washington and said, you know, get after Hollywood. Now,
So they actually called for Washington to police the industry.
Oh, yes.
Because they saw a threat from the left there.
Now, you can imagine how that appealed to the House Un-American Activities Committee, which, by the way, was a committee of long standing. Before that, it had been run by people like Hamilton Fish and I don't know who else, but it had always been a kind of a troublesome thing, but they'd never picked on Hollywood. All of a sudden, they saw a chance to get a tremendous amount of national publicity, and they jumped at it.
So you think the reason they made such a big deal out of the showcase HUAC hearings was just publicity for the Congress people?
Well, I think without question.
Who was the head of the House of Un-American Activities?
Congressman named Thomas.
J. Parnell Thomas.
J. Parnell Thomas, yes, indeed.
What sort of a character was he? He was the one that led these witch hunt
inquisitions. Well, he was a choleric character looked as though he were ready to burst any minute from high blood pressure, red in the face, shouting constantly, banging the gavel, screaming at people. And incidentally, he got sent to jail for malfeasance in office, and he was in jail at the same time that one of the Hollywood Ten were, and with a couple of the Hollywood Ten, he was in Connecticut at Danville, I think it was Danville, Connecticut.
So he was a crook, actually.
Aren't half the congressmen?
Well, not half of them, I would say.
Who's being tried now and before the Senate? Yeah. Oh, my. Well, I don't know that half, no, but a number, let's say.
Mm-hmm. I think was he a right-winger of the McCarthyist stripe? Was he like one of these professional Cold War anti-communists, or was he just out for his own power?
Well, I think very much like McCarthy, because I think McCarthy was out for his own power, mm-hmm. too. I don't think McCarthy
They just exploited that issue.
They exploited it. It was a great... Well, it's to this very day, it's an issue. All you've got to do is to say about somebody, hey, he's a communist, and immediately anything he says loses value. Nobody wants to listen to him. Everybody is afraid of him. Even to this very day, it's true. Now, that's the way it works.
Wasn't there a young congressman from California on that committee?
There was. He was a freshman congressman.
What was his name?
Named Richard Milhouse Nixon.
Oh, yes. We heard of now him later, didn't we?
They started calling him Tricky Dick even at that time. This is going to alienate all the Republicans that are watching. But or at least some of them. You mean Republicans never watch this program?
No. I'm sure we have good Republicans in our audience.
Anyway, he did a very interesting thing. You could tell. Now, he was the youngest man and the newest congressman on that panel. Sat way over, strangely enough, on the left facing us, but it was on the right from his point of view, so I guess it was okay. But he sat on that panel during the first week when the friendly witnesses were on and when they were getting after the heads of the studios. They treated him like children, accusing him of all kinds of horrible things. He was the man, because he was from Southern California, and he was there to he was the man who would ask the questions after the chairman got through riding Warner or Mayor or whoever it was. He was the one that would ask the questions. It would bring decent answers from them, you know. Which
he was their friendly question.
Yes, he was their friendly question.
Because it was a movie state that he...
Right. But the minute that they started calling the unfriendly witnesses, us, the Hollywood... we were originally the Hollywood 19. We called the Hollywood 10 because 9 weren't called. Anyway, he left. He had business... I think he had to go to the toilet in Whittier. And he left for California. Which was very, very cagey, because he didn't know how this was going to work out. At that time, publicity in the newspaper and everything was all in our favor. Mm-hmm. Everybody hated the committee throughout the country. The radio, everything was for us. And so he didn't know really how that was going to work. I think if he'd known how it was going to work out, he would have stayed there.
Right.
Later on, he did with the pumpkin papers and things. But this was his introduction to that kind of activity.
I think he probably learned a key lesson that was instrumental for him, and that is how to exploit anti-communism as a political issue to gain power. That's what McCarthy did, this J. Parnell Thomas. And I think that's where Nixon learned his lesson of how to be successful.
I think so.
That you could win power by exploiting the anti-communist issue here in this. Well, what finally happened then to the Hollywood Ten?
We went to jail eventually.
How come? What was?
Well, we were cited for contempt of Congress because none of us would testify. We would give our names and addresses, and that was it. And we made a stand, which I think was kind of silly, but it was a principled stand on the basis of the right of free speech. We did not invoke the Fifth Amendment. This is one of the reasons I had left the Communist Party before, but one of the reasons that I left the group eventually and disavowed the group was that the whole thing was a put-up job by the communists were being just as bad about it as J. Parnell Thomas was. And this was their strategy, that we would fight it on the grounds of free speech and not plead self-incrimination because the fear of self-incrimination, because that was tantamount to a kind of confession that we were, of course, we all were communists, we had been. We all weren't communists because Adrian Scott had gotten out
of... Or have you ever been?
Yeah, well, we had been, yeah. And Adrian Scott and I had gotten out of the party some time before. But we had been members of the party at one time.
And perhaps you could go back a step and ask and tell us why you got in to the Communist Party and then why you got disillusioned.
I got into the Communist Party for the same reason that all intellectuals got into the Communist Party, because they were the only people that seemed to be doing anything for people. They were the only ones that were, for public housing, for decent welfare treatment, for all those things. They were against bigotry. long before it was common. They were against anti-Semitism, any kind of bigotry of any kind. They stood for all the things that I think any, you know, progressive young person stands for. And they have a wonderful front. After I got in, I found out that this was a front, that this wasn't really what they were doing. They were doing it, but behind it was a big power grab. Mm-hmm. And my experiences since then have backed that up. For instance, I spent 6 months in Hungary about 6 years ago now, I guess. And I found it very pleasant, by the way, but I also found that the countries behind the Iron Curtain are really state capitalisms. They're not
or bureaucratic
social societies.
Communism.
Of course,
it isn't
yeah, but
real
it's not real communism, is
right.
it?
It's not Marxist.
The two things don't go together. Yeah.
Right.
But I knew that before.
How did you first get disillusioned with the Communist Party? You weren't in very long, were you?
I was in a very short while. No, I got disillusioned because of a film that I made called Cornered, one of the films you mentioned. The second picture I made with Dick Powell. And it had been written by a man who was a communist, and it was, I won't mention his name here, but it was full of I do in the book, by the way, yeah. So it's not that I'm afraid to, but it was full of speeches, communist speeches, you know. Now, one of the things that, although all my pictures have had messages, one of the things I've been very careful about is that the picture is entertaining. I want the people to be entertained, to get the message, you know, it's what I call the pill. It's a tiny core of ideology or message of some sort, but with a huge pill of sugar around it for them to swallow. For instance, Crossfire, which was the first picture against anti-Semitism, is a murder story. And Adrian Scott, who was a producer, was also a communist at that time, and we read the script and said, gee, this is dreadful. This is nothing but manifestos, and the people are going to get very, very bored. So we got John Paxton, who had written Murder, My Sweet, to come in and change. Actually, it had been Scott's fault because he had hired this man to do it as a party member instead of getting John to begin with. So John rewrote it, and we made a pretty interesting suspense story. When it was all finished, all of a sudden we were called. Adrian and I were called into a meeting, and I didn't even know what it was all about. But it was an intra-party meeting. And the writer had called in two or three, among them John Howard Lawson, who was head of the Communist Party in Hollywood at the time. And they said to us, you've got to reshoot the scenes as this author has written them and put it in the picture. Well, the picture was ready to be released. We couldn't have done it without going to the heads of the studio and saying, we want to do this. And they would have said, why? And we would have said, because the communists aren't happy with it. And, of course, they were so impractical.
Isn't it also unrealistic because it was not one Hollywood film that had used communist propaganda in speeches?
Couldn't.
So given the fact that it was impossible to do this, wasn't Lawson and these party ideologues totally out of touch with reality and demanding that you do this?
Not from their point of view. You see, this is the whole thing, the communist kind of thinking as opposed to our kind of thinking, or just general, you know, what you would consider logical thinking. For instance, they did the same thing. One of the things that happened while I was with the group, between the time that we were indicted and the time we went to jail, we used to hold meetings every week. And when I was in this country, I had to leave to make a little living abroad. But I was in quite a bit of the time. And we used to have meetings. And at a couple of these meetings, Bob Rawson had just, I think, won an award, and his film had, for All the King's Men, mm-hmm. which was, my God, if there was ever a story about corruption in high places in the United States, that's it. You'd think the communists would have been jumping up and down in, with happiness. They brought him up on the carpet. And they scolded him like a little tiny child. Well, he finally said, "Nuts to you," in plainer terms than that, and walked out. And I'm sure he walked out of the party too at the same time. But you say, now why? Why would they do that to a man like that? What have they got to gain? The picture's already released. It's been seen by people. It's being seen by people. It's being highly regarded, and yet they treated him that way. I think that it's the Communist Party, like a religious order, absolutely depends on obedience.
Discipline.
And obedience. And you must obey, and you must kneel to the discipline of the party. That's the first thing they tell you that. They warn you about it. They don't, of course, it sneaks up on you gradually because you don't know what the discipline is going to be. It's not going to be that silly, but it is. And I think they're afraid that when somebody does something like Rawson did, that he's going to get a big head and he's going to consider himself important. So they want to chop it off right now. They want to say, hey, look, you're just another guy down here as far as we're concerned. You've got to take our orders. We're the big shots, not you.
That's curious.
It's the only thing that explains it.
Something in your book was curious that I wanted to ask you about. At this time, right after you joined the Communist Party, you made a film, Back to Bataan, with John Wayne.
Oh, yeah.
In the Philippines. I was wondering how you got along with Wayne. Was he that much of a right-wing?
Oh, he was very right-wing. But and I think he knew at the time, because he was very close to DeMille. I think he knew that I'd been a communist, although he never said so. But he said to me at one time, he said, Eddie, he said, we really believe in the same things. We only want to go about getting them in different ways. Now, this was quite a statement. Of course, ever since then, he's gone, because every time he writes an article about communism in Hollywood, he goes out of his way to mention me and how horrible, even though he knows that I left the party centuries ago, even before I had been before Congress. But he's always gotten after me for that. I think it was because he was learning how to play chess then, and we played a game, and I beat him in 11 moves.
Little fool's mate there, huh?
Oh, he prides himself on the chess terribly.
Well, before we get to your 1950 blockbusters, I just want to mention that one of your best movies was made before you were put in jail, before you were sentenced, and that is Christ in Concrete, a movie that you made in Britain. Tom, do you have a couple comments on this film that you might want to make to call attention to its importance in the 50s? I think we both share the same respect for it.
It is, for my money, probably the strongest humanist manifesto that came out of Hollywood, that did not come out of Hollywood, that was released in the West, shall we say, that was made primarily by Hollywood people during the Cold War. It's an absolutely incredible film, black and white movie, which extols the trials and tribulations of the working class and just of city life. And in terms of what Ed was saying before about the sugar-coated pill, very little sugar coating in this movie. It's very direct and very powerful.
Very realistic.
And dealing with issues from marital sexuality to
labor
relations, unions, etc.
Immigrant experiences.
Not to mention the incredible production values in that film. Before we leave,
I want to make one comment on this, too. I think it's probably the most hard-hitting, realistic look at the Depression of America. It's amazing that during the 1930s and even the 1940s, there were few realistic pictures of the Depression. Maybe The Grapes of Wrath.
The Grapes of Wrath
is
the other one.
Yeah. But even it was sentimental and romanticized, etc. Whereas Dimitri's film, Give Us This Day, is a really realistic, hard-hitting look at the poverty and the suffering in Depression America, and a brilliant exploration of working class and ethnic life.
The only thing I object to here is you make it sound dreadfully down and dour, and it's not. It's an enjoyable film, in case you ever have a chance to see it.
It's extremely enjoyable. But
it's not all that, not all that horrible all the way through.
You have a lot of opportunities to upbeat the film, though, and you have the opportunities to upbeat the film in a more traditional Hollywood manner, and you don't do it.
Oh, no, well, I didn't want to, because that is my favorite film, and that's the one over which I had the most control, almost complete, and I must say, I love every foot of it. By the way, it won all the awards in Europe that year, when it came out, and when they released it here, the American Legion went to the various theaters and said, if you don't withdraw this film, we will boycott you from now on. So the exhibitors, being intelligent men, stopped running the film. Actually, it started off with some great reviews, and in those places where it was, like New York and L.A., where it did run for a few days, it ran to good crowds, but then was yanked. So it was seen by practically nobody in this country except those who happened to see it in the first day or two.
You know, Ed, this really frightens me, this whole story of the fragility of democracy in American society.
Why does it frighten you?
Some of the best directors and film people in Hollywood were hounded by these witch hunt committees in Congress. They were put in jail. Your film, that was one of the best films of the period, was boycotted by these right-wing groups so that it wasn't even shown.
Are you one of these silly people who think America is the freest country in the world?
Well, I just think that the promise of America is its democracy.
Oh, promise, yes, but we have never come up to it. I've lived in countries all over the world, and although I prefer it, I'm an American. An American by choice. As you know, I'm a naturalized American, but I prefer living here. I could have, after I got out of England, I could have gone back out of jail. I could have gone back to England, to Europe, to work forever. I was sent telegrams. Rank sent me a telegram offering me a very fine deal, but I wanted to stay here in this country. But I think we should be realistic about what kind of a country we live in. We live in a country with the greatest promise in the world, but that has never come up anywhere near that promise. And we tell ourselves we're the best informed people in the world. We're not. The English are much better informed than we are. The French are better informed than we are. The Swiss are better informed. I'm not even taking into consideration the Scandinavian countries.
We had a professor from Yugoslavia here a couple of weeks ago who talked about the peasants in Yugoslavia know almost everything about American politics.
That's right.
Whereas we know nothing about Central Europe. Gerald Ford didn't even know that Poland was part of the Soviet bloc and was oppressed by Russian domination in presidential debates.
Well, this is the way. You know, I found when I went to England that Rank, for whom I went to work there, who helped finance both pictures I made there, he asked me to come see him. The Rank at that time was the motion picture business in England. But the point is that he was originally, and was still at that time, one of the richest men in England. He was a mill owner, a multi-millionaire, one of the biggest financiers and businessmen. And he said to me, I don't care what your politics are.
Let me ask you a question before we leave the HUAC situation. You were, if I'm not mistaken, the only director among the Hollywood Ten.
Bieberman, in a way, was a director.
Well,
you were the only major
really.
Director.
Yeah, I was
right.
Yeah.
And you were the only one who, in effect, could not continue working under some kind
right.
of a... there were a lot of people working
I
under Dalton
write.
Trumbo, and
I
the boys were writing
under
pseudonyms
yeah.
and all that business. How did you feel, first of all, about being in such a visible production role that you couldn't possibly work? And how did you feel about all those writers, especially in the last couple of decades, who were able to work all that time, were able to make a living, and not visibly compromise their ideology?
I think they were very lucky. I think.
Do you resent them at all?
I don't resent anybody, neither on one side nor the other. As a matter of fact, as far as I'm concerned, they were both doing their thing. The ones on the extreme right were fighting to defend what they thought was right, their futures, their livelihoods. I think they're completely wrong. But the point is, they think that they're right, which is the important thing. If there's one thing in the world I hate, it's anybody or anything doctrinaire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that anybody knows the truth about anything. And I cannot get mad at people because they believe one thing and I believe another. Because it's just possible that I might be wrong and they might be right. So I don't blame the people on the left. I don't blame the people on the right. I feel a little bitter. No, I don't, about the communists, because I joined them of my own free will. I got out. I don't like them because of their doctrinaire attitude. But as far as resenting anybody, not in the least. I'm very happy those guys could. They didn't make a very good living. Look, they took advantage of them. Dalton Trumbo was selling things for $5,000 that he could have gotten $100,000 for if he weren't on the blacklist.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to make a living.
Well, you made a remarkable comeback in the 1950s after getting out of jail. I think it was Stanley Kramer who gave you a contract to make four films, the fourth of which was The Caine Mutiny,
right.
which was a blockbuster. It was one of the most popular films of the 50s.
Yep. Of all time.
Of all time, absolutely. Do you think it was that really got your career rolling again, The Caine Mutiny, and its tremendous success?
Well, undoubtedly it helped, sure. No, but I still had a reputation with the filmmakers. The thing that was that they didn't know was whether the American public would accept me or not. You know, and this is why I made one for the King Brothers for $5,000 first, just to prove that they wouldn't come down, that the American Legion and others wouldn't come down on my neck. And then the thing with Kramer helped. Columbia had wanted me to come in, but something had happened which I don't want to go into now, which had killed that deal right after I got out of jail.
It's in your book.
Yeah, it's in the book. But without doubt, the fact although I had made my deal already to go on to make Broken Lance at Fox with Spencer Tracy before this picture, before Caine Mutiny was even out. So I was back on the market, and people knew I could make good films, and I would have gone on whether that... Of course, if that had been a bust, that would have hurt me, but the fact that it was a big success certainly didn't hurt me any.
How was the transition from working in black and white, lower-budget pictures to those big budget, lush budget, widescreen Technicolor features with people like Tracy and Bogart and Brando, etc.?
No problem. No problem at all. I didn't like the way, in those days, in the early days of color, we couldn't use it very intelligently. They always wanted bright color, and we would get beautiful effects on the original film, and when they got through the printing at Technicolor, it would be postcardy, as we called it, and we hated it. But I wish I could shoot some of the black and white films in color now, because you can get the same effects now. You can do anything you want with color now. As for the other, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed, in the first place, working with actors like Spencer Tracy. There's no substitute for excellence. Those were the greatest actors in the business. Tracy, Bogart, Brando, Monty Cliff, the people I was able to work with, were great actors, let's face it. And they're better actors than working with second-rate actors. You know, Dick Powell, whom I loved, was a good friend of mine and who did beautifully in the films he did for me, but he was a guy who would say, you know, tell me what to do and I'll do it. And when I got with the other, they were creative actors. I could say to them, what would you like to do here? Let's come up with something. I didn't have to tell them what to do. And there's a big difference there, because there's no reason why the actor shouldn't create with you. Everybody, you know, should create, not just the director.
When you were working on these larger budget pictures, did you find you had less control over the production when there was more money tied up in the films?
No, that's not true. No, not at all. I was very lucky up until the last few years of my career. I had pretty good control over everything. And as I say, the one thing that you never get enough of is time. Mm-hmm. So, and that costs money. So it was nice to be able to work for 130, although it wasn't actually, because once you go over 40 days, that seems to be kind of, after that you get paranoid, and you hate everybody, and you think everybody's out to get you, and my God, God is out to get you, and people are out to get you, and your actors aren't, you know, are out to get you, and everything. Your wife is out to get you, your children are making, this is a miserable business in that respect. But still, you have time enough to get, you know, the kind of performances you want and the kind of effects you want.
Speaking of time, you note in your book that the original version of the Kane Mutiny was over 3 hours, and I think Raintree County was something like 4 hours. Did you have battles with the studios over cuts?
Yes, it did. Not in Raintree County, strangely enough, although that too had its side. There were three interesting... do you have the time for all
sure,
this?
Sure, let's
My
go.
God, this goes on forever. The Kane Mutiny... I wrote about it in the book. Cohen and Kramer had never gotten along. It was mostly Kramer's fault. Kramer thought that Cohen was a prostitute, and he wouldn't consult him about anything. He used his money, but he would never consult him about anything. So in the original deal that they had made, there was a little clause that said no picture can go over 2 hours, and no picture can cost more than $2 million. Now, for the kind of pictures that Kramer had made, the kind that the other three that I made for him cost about $500,000 or $600,000, you know, and ran an hour and 40 minutes, there was no problem. But along came Kane Mutiny, the last picture on the deal, and it was a huge bestseller, a tremendously big book, and which certainly should have cost more than $2 million. Well, we had a great cast. We were lucky that, and I should have taken 100 or 120 days to do it, and it should have run 3 hours, but it didn't. Because we weren't allowed to. We just weren't allowed. Cohen said, if you do it, the studio takes over. And Kramer didn't want to lose control of it. So we had to get it in 2 hours. And we had to get it in. It took me only 54 days to make that film. I took about 150 days on Raintree County. I took 135 on Young Lions. I took more on lesser pictures than that weren't that complex. We had to go like a son of a bitch on that one, pardon me. We had to go very fast on that and make it in 54 days. That was the schedule.
Isn't there a stupidity, though, on the part of the Hollywood studios that concluded that the audience couldn't watch anything more than 2 hours, whereas Gone with the Wind and several other pictures approved?
That wasn't it. That wasn't, you know, now let me give it. I don't, why do people get all these misconceptions? Mm-hmm. Very simple. If a picture is 2 hours long, you can run in 10 hours, you can run it five times. If it's 3 hours long, in 10 hours, you can only run it three times.
So it's capital.
So you make less money.
That's
exactly what it is, and they told me that, because about a year or two later, I was doing a picture for Fox, and the executive who was in charge of worldwide distribution for Columbia was on the set visiting, and I said to him, why the devil didn't you let us make... I said, Kane Mutiny could have been a classic of all time if we had just been able to spend as much time on it as we could and made it a longer picture. We had the script, by the way, originally. We had to hack the script down to get it into that time. We had a great script. And he said just exactly that. He said, we wanted more showing. We wanted to get our money back faster. I said, but maybe if it had been a better film, you could have gotten it would have taken you longer, but you would have gotten more money back in the long run. He said, well, we wanted to get it back in a hurry. And, of course, they did. They got a tremendous amount of money in a hurry out of that. That's the answer. Now, on the others, for instance, Young Lions, I had a very interesting... The picture, that film ran something over 3 hours, about 3 hours and 20 or 25 minutes. And the executives came out after we had finished making it, the executives from New York, the brass, as we call them, came out to look at the film, and we ran it for them one evening, and I have never, I've never gotten such a reaction from executives. They loved it. When it was all over, they were all crying to begin with, but crying, in the happy way. And Skouras, who was head of the company, got up and said, "Oh, this is the greatest thing Box has ever made. It's wonderful." And they were talking about it, and then one of them suddenly looked down at the watch. He said, because they hadn't even noticed it. Nobody had said it's long. They hadn't noticed it. And he suddenly said, "How long is the picture?" And I said, 3 hours and 20 minutes. He said, "You got to take out a half an hour." I mean, that's what I call the Pavlovian reflex. You give them a time, and they say, "Cut it down." No matter what, if you'd said 1 hour and 40 minutes, he'd have said, "Take out 10 minutes." It's just that, and we did. We took out a couple of very important scenes to do that. Now, the thing on Raintree County again was a different aspect of Hollywood. That picture was made while Dori Sherry was in charge of the studio. Now, after I'd finished shooting, and while I was still in the process of editing, not too long before our first preview, as a matter of fact, Dori was fired, let go. So was the producer of the picture. So I was left there with the film. And the new executives took over, and they didn't want anything made under Dori to look particularly good. We went to a preview at Santa Barbara. I'll never forget it, because we had a fantastically successful preview again. Everybody loved the film. I stood out in the lobby, as we always do, watching the people come out and sign those cards and everything. And then the executives came out, and one of them said to the other with a terribly dour look, "He liked it." As though that was the worst thing that could possibly happen to him. They wanted the picture to be hated, even though it had cost $6 million, which at that time was a tremendous amount of money. They wanted the picture to be disliked. They wanted it to be a failure. And it was originally made in 65 millimeter, the first Panavision 65, and it was beautiful in that, and they decided to throw that away, and they cut it down, not too much, but they cut it down a little bit. I had quite a few problems there.
Ed, there's one thing in conclusion I'd like to ask you that's sort of a puzzle for me. You made some of the most popular films of the 1950s and 60s, were both critically acclaimed and very successful and popular at the box office, like Soldier of Fortune with Clark Gable, Raintree County, The Young Lions, and The Caine Mutiny that we just discussed. Films in the 1960s like Mirage, The Carpetbaggers, but yet you had trouble financing films in the late 1960s. What changes in Hollywood made it difficult for the previous studio directors like yourself to get financing?
Because the day of the entrepreneur came in. Today is the day of the financier filmmaker, and most of them are not filmmakers, they're financiers. The man that can get the money is the man in power, because the studios do not finance pictures, very rarely. They might, if they've made $200 million on Jaws 1, they may finance Jaws 2, because they feel they've got a sure thing. But they didn't finance Jaws 1, only they gave him probably a negative pickup or something of that sort. They do not finance, so you have to have somebody who can go out and get the money. Go to Texas Millionaires, go to Holland, go to Switzerland, wherever, and get the dough. I can't borrow a nickel from you. I don't have that gift. It is a gift. And unfortunately, some of the people that have the gift for getting the money don't know, most of them don't know how to make pictures. And unless you get an interesting combination, which happens in some cases, of a director who is a good director working with a partner who happens to be a great moneymaker, that, of course, is, I never could find a man like that to work with me.
So the studio system of Hollywood has been much maligned. It was actually a blessing in disguise, in that at least it enabled people like yourself to make films without having to worry about financing.
Exactly. It's very ironic, because even I, as one of the others, we used to say, "Oh, this will be a great day when we can get out of this factory, this assembly line, and when the artists can make the films they want." Well, the artists took over. Unfortunately, the artists are very stupid about their films. The actors took over. Actors really wield the great power, because if you can get a great actor, if you can pay him $3 or $4 million, you can get the money, strangely enough, to back him, even though the chances are that you'll never see your money, because the picture's going to cost far too much. But they pick the worst possible material for themselves, honestly, in every way. And also, they give you a much rougher time when you're making the films, and the studios. I never had any trouble with Zanuck or with Cohn or with these people. Never. But you can have a hell of a lot of trouble with Sean Connery or with Steve McQueen or with somebody like that. Mm. Or with Barbara Streisand, as everybody knows. And it's not for the good of the picture either.
Mm. Well, what we've talked about today is the rise and, as it turns out, the decline of the Hollywood studio system. Our guest was Edward Dimitrik, who was with Hollywood from the beginning. And
not
we
quite.
Well, almost from the beginning. And we want to thank him and Tom Schatz for this fascinating Hollywood memoir. Thank you for watching, and good evening.
Thank you.